music of the David Sanford Big Band on Greenleaf Music, and I'll be talking to David Sanford today in this episode. Really great big band, and we talk about all kinds of music, composition ideas, of course. We both started on trombone, and we talk about all kinds of things. We talk about Hugh Reagan, and we listen to a bunch of his music. So I hope you enjoy this episode. As always, please come and visit us, greenleafmusic.com, where you can get all of these episodes and the entire catalog of music by subscribing. It's a great collection of all sorts of artists and music and a lot of my music. And it's our pleasure to keep that going. So please come join us, greenleafmusic.com. And here is the episode with David Sanford. David Sanford, so great to talk to you. Thanks for making the time. We were hearing your piece, Pop It. It's just an honor to get to talk to you and to have released this record at Greenleaf Music.
The honor is all mine. Thank you very much for having me on the label and here.
You're very welcome. Poking around a little bit, and I realized we're both born the same year, and we both started on the same instrument. But we took different paths. Your bio anyway says that you were really fascinated by big bands right from the beginning, and I'm wondering if that's related to Pittsburgh, because I know that the connection to Pittsburgh is important for you.
I wish it was. I started on trombone in Pittsburgh, but I didn't really take to it. My brother started on, it's a circuitous path how I got to trombone. I actually started on trumpet, believe it or not, and I couldn't get a note out of it. So that lasted about 2 weeks. And then they moved me to euphonium. And
exactly the reverse for me.
Oh, right. Okay.
Started on trombone and switched to trumpet. Yeah. So you went to euphonium.
Right, and then the middle valve stuck, and so they had to set it off somewhere to get it fixed. In the meantime, they gave me a trombone, so I ended up playing the same instrument as my brother, which, of course, is the worst. I mean, we're 2 years apart, but, you know, we end up competing and everything, so that was just another thing that sort of became an issue between the two of us. And, he had started on it, so. But yeah, after moving to Colorado was really, we had an outstanding junior high band director named William McMosley, who just passed away recently. And my brother was in junior high at that time. I was still in grade school, and he said, "I'll come and check out our big band rehearsing." And I knew very little about big bands. And it was one of those things where the minute I heard them, I was just in awe. I just loved it. I mean, I wanted to, I couldn't believe, for one thing, the trombones got to play something so cool. I don't think I'd ever heard saxes up close like that. And I'd never seen improvised solos and knew that that's what they were doing. So it was, one of those moments where you can just say, wow, my life has changed.
Did you feel like, as a trombonist, being in the middle of that maelstrom of big band arranging was part of what led you to composition?
Definitely. Yeah. I think my earliest interest in wanting to do something, that director left after my seventh grade year. In eighth grade, somehow, I don't know why, our library became completely barren, but there was just nothing there. And I remember thinking, boy, it'd be really cool if we could do the Bob Newhart theme, the Pat Williams, like a junior high band playing this, of course. Now I'm laughing about it. But so I thought, hey, I could take this, but long before I had a tape of it, I'm just trying to do it from memory and write it out. And I had no idea what else happened in that piece other than the minute and a half that you get, on the take on the actual television broadcast. And I tried writing that out, and I have no idea what it sounds like. I mean, my director copied it out from the score, and I think we looked at it one day and, you know, obviously couldn't get past bar one. So that was, but yeah, I think I immediately kind of wanted to be part of that. And then of course, the more music I actually heard in that genre, you know, I can remember Woody Herman's Jim Pugh's version of Crosswinds, and we knew Crosswinds from Billy Cobham, but you know, his has this whole fugal thing in the middle, and I thought that was just an absolute gas. Of course, everything Maynard Ferguson did was wonderful. You know, those early bands you first hear, you know, I think all of those, and just even high school and junior high bands that you hear at jazz festivals, you just went, wow, you know, that drummer was funky as heck, you know, and so forth. So yeah, it was life changing.
And do you still play trombone?
Since I had kids, I don't have the time that I used to. I teach at Mount Holyoke College, and they have a big band, which very often does not fill out the low brass section. So I will sit in on bass trombone. And there was a long period where I didn't play at all, between really 85 to 2000 or so. And then it took me forever to get my lip back then. Now it's just, it's not great, but I never had great chops to begin with. So yeah, when I have a chance, I mean, I've played with the orchestra there, or I'll play with the big band there. But yeah, it's few and far in between. And I don't know, maybe once, you know, either when I'm retired or when the kids are moved on to college, I might try and get back to it if I still have anything to offer.
Long tones.
Right. Carmine Caruso, right?
Hey, well, yeah, sure. That's a whole other thing. But so do you feel like your main thing as a performer then is being a conductor at this point and since that time?
As a performer, yes. I'm kind of one of those people that loves watching other people do it. And, you know, I air instrument probably as much, if not more, than almost anybody I know. But I don't love seeing my face in front of an audience. I sure as heck don't like hearing my own voice. I did a lot of singing in high school. I did vocal jazz choir in college, and I do not like to hear my own voice. So I'm perfectly happy to fill out a chord or something like that. But yeah, as a performer, it's a wrestling match, and I'd much rather listen to other people do it.
But I mean, being the conductor, especially of a big band like this one, you know, and being the composer, it's almost like you sort of have to be there to transmit the energy.
I guess, yeah, I mean, yeah, well, now you mentioned it, sure. I actually cannot see anybody else leading my stuff. I mean, I'm sure somebody could do it, but, you know, specifically, you know, the band itself or my music, I think probably plenty of other people could do it, but in that way that, you know, J.C. Sanford leads John Hollenbeck's band, you know, and John plays drums. Like, I somehow couldn't imagine myself playing trombone in my own group and somebody else conducting it. So, yeah, in that respect, I guess, yeah, I thought about it.
Well, also because your pieces, you know, it's obvious that you love the big band, but also the compositional, the conception, you know, your point of departure is so unique and unusual. And so for somebody else to sort of assimilate that and figure out how to conduct it maybe would be a larger task than normal.
I think there is something where you hear interpretations, and like, I never thought of myself as a classical conductor. I mean, I think I'd just be happy to get through it. And yet I'm aware of the pieces I know well, I would want it to go that way, you know, you know, this needs to be drawn out. This climax needs to be bigger. Somebody needs to bring the horns out more here and so forth. So, you know, it's obviously people do that in the studio a lot, but when you're live, you know, there's often that sense of, wow, I wish they had done so-and-so. So yeah, in that respect, I guess I'm uncomfortable being an autocrat or.
but also, I mean, in that regard, your music really falls in an interesting place, you know, between the rigors of composition and spontaneous improvisation, you know, the alchemy that comes with the excitement of live performance. Mm-hmm. And so you as a conductor, I'm sure, I've actually never seen you conduct the band, but I'm sure there's a lot of, you know, moment to moment decision making and kind of frantic arm waving, you know, beyond just, I wish they had done this, but more like, okay, this section, this is how this is going to take shape now, and I'm guiding them through it.
I don't think I have that kind of autonomy in my work, such as, you know, by comparison to the conductions that, you know, like Hugh's doing, and obviously Butch Morris, and, you know, quite a few people, you know, who've been doing them, with Adam Rudolph. You know, that's really, you're shaping every aspect of the piece. You know, you're drawing, you're saying, okay, now it's here, now it's here. Generally, my stuff is written out, mm-hmm. you know, pretty much, and yeah, there are moments in it where you can stretch the form. You know, there's one place in Poppet where you can mm-hmm. go as long as you want, you know, and, but, you know, for the most of the rest of it, it's going to start. And once it's going, you're just kind of standing back and, you know, putting beats in the right places.
So where does a piece like Poppet, you know, what's the inception of the idea for a piece like that?
I'm sort of, it's, you know, there's a part of me that I feel like I've gotten older and I've matured. I mean, things I didn't appreciate when I was younger, I, you know, trying to think of a good example. I would say love songs, particularly. This is one for a psychiatrist, but you know, relationships. You know, when I was younger, anybody who knew me from Northern Colorado, if you said, "Could you imagine that person married with kids?" they would have died laughing. I mean, I was not wound tight, but you know, I was neurotic and, you know, self-loathing, I suppose. But at some point, yeah, I got to appreciate where love songs come from. I can remember actually having, you know, when my daughter was first born and, you know, trying to come up with songs to sing as lullabies for her. And there were all these gorgeous tunes like Stardust and, you know, that I don't necessarily, Body and Soul, you know, old standards and stuff, things that I used to have no use for. You know, it's like somebody else can do those. I've got my own ideas of where I want to go and so forth. And I think I learned to appreciate those. So while that has sort of grown, I was sort of thinking, okay, well, so I've mellowed out in some other respects. I think, yes, I mean, I heard just recently my old senior recital tape from my, I don't know why, I just came across it and I was listening to it from my senior recital. And anybody who knew me from Northern Colorado knows I had a piece that I worked on for 4 years there called The Rise and Fall of the Black Death. It was about that subtle.
Period. And, yeah.
Uh-huh. And I was listening to it and it was kind of like, you know, the conception of it, you know, I still think of it in an interesting way. Like I had there, because it kept changing. I kept adding in things, of course, and it just got overwrought. But listen to it, it's like, oh, I can't, you know, I mean, it's not something, I mean, I still own the score and the parts, but there's no way I would ever put that in front of an audience now. It's just, it's, you know, but that said, the subtlety still is not something that I'm after. You know, I'm sort of, I think particularly, you know, when you see, I mean, I grew up on drum and bugle corps for one thing, which are not subtle things either. But if you watch a drum and bugle corps now, it's a very tasteful, you know, I mean, when they get to the end of the show, they'll sort of pull out all the stops and, you know, you'll get this big wall of sound and they'll get that, you know, that edge on it where, you know, the middle horns are just, you know, just seriously searing your ears off. But the rest of the show, they kind of keep it under control and so forth. And that's, you know, it's musical. And it's wonderfully musical. There's a part of me, though, that remembers back in the 70s where the cores that scored the highest in Hornline were the ones who played the loudest, you know. And so when they first came out, it was like, they would just sear your ears off. And then during the show, they'd be searing your ears off. You know, they turn to the back of the field and they'd be blasting to the back of the field and so forth. And I'm not saying that's what I want to do, but I do kind of miss that. I mean, and I think that's something that you heard in a lot of big bands. I think big bands played that way. I think Buddy Rich certainly played that way.
David, this is your way of explaining where the inception of your ideas comes from?
Well, I'm just saying as far as Poppet goes, you know, Poppet
okay.
is...
Okay, fair enough.
Right. I have a piece called Fenwick, which was one of the first pieces I wrote knowing fully well that I want, you know, what the big band was going to be back in 2003 when I just started really getting time to write big band music. Mm-hmm. And I chose the name Fenwick because the character Fenwick in the movie Diner by Barry Levinson, played by Kevin Bacon, there's a scene where he does a very stupid practical joke, and he's like dying laughing. You know, I mean, these are guys who are supposed to be ostensibly in like their early 20s or college, you know, post college age or something. He's just laughing, like he's like, I was waiting weeks to get you guys with this and so forth. And he said, hey, you really got us, Fenwick. And Ellen Barkin's character says, that's very mature, Fenwick. And he says, blank mature. He goes, oh, sorry, you know, and he sort of apologizes. But I said, okay, that's sort of my idea of subtlety here. Like, I'm not in that particular piece. I said, I'm not going to be subtle. And I think other pieces I've been more or less, you know, withdrawn and so forth. But Poppet, there is nothing subtle about Poppet. It's pretty much just straightforward. It's saying, here's what we do, and that's what you're going to get.
So it sounds like a lot of the inceptions of the ideas are images more than musical motives or some sort of strategic thinking. It's more like, you know, you've discovered a feeling from a story or an image that you're going to somehow represent in this piece, and then figuring out how to get to that.
Yes, it depends on the piece, but right. Some of them more so than others.
What would you say about V-Reel?
V-Reel, that started, I'll try and do it quickly. That was an idea I had in a bar long before the band, long before I wrote it. I mean, I wrote the piece in 2003. I had the idea in 1987 or 88. I was in a bar in Boston listening to a band, and I don't think it's had anything to do with the band, but I remember thinking, if you could take that huge wall of brass and complexity from Bob Gradinger's City of Glass that Kenton recorded, and I love City of Glass, but it does not swing, and that's not, it's not supposed to swing. That's not the point there. But I kept thinking, if you could take that and put a beat under it, similar to Super Stupid by Funkadelic, then it would be amazing. So it's kind of, in that respect, it's a simple answer, is it's a mashup. But, and then there's like, I just started adding a ton of stuff to it. But, you know, I did specify, and like some drummers give you more Super Stupid, some of give you less of it. But, you know, I think some of those textures are meant to be similar to what Gradinger had with City of Glass. And,
wow.
But then there were other things I added to it, probably that just sort of seemed somewhat related to it. There's a Cantus Firmus in it and so forth. So
let me just play a little bit of that. So that's an excerpt of V-Reel from your new album, A Prayer for Lester Bowie, and with your big band. Super Stupid is a super interesting and unexpected choice. And then you told me that you wrote your dissertation on the music of the 1970s as a PhD candidate at Princeton. And then a lot of things started to make more sense for me, and yet there were a lot more questions that I had about it. I know Agartha was a big part of that dissertation, and in the extra, we can chat about that piece, the Miles Davis performance, Agartha, which is amazing, from 1975. But how does a piece like Super Stupid play into your Princeton PhD dissertation?
Princeton was, oddly enough, they were open to the stuff that I was doing, very encouraging. It's funny because everybody had this idea. I think it, as a department, they changed, to me, seemingly overnight. My first 2 years, it was still kind of, I mean, if you look at the faculty, you wouldn't necessarily have said so, but it still felt like it was the Milton Babbitt 12-tone set theory department. And I mean, certainly the students, there were a lot of people from Juilliard who were still writing, you know, very modernist approaches to music. And I took a year off. And when I came back, all of a sudden, there were a ton of minimalists. And I think the aesthetic of Paul Lansky and Steve Mackey kind of became where the students were going. Specifically, I think with Steve, you know, was a rock and roll guitarist. And I think he kind of encouraged, you know, and I think, you know, Julia Wolf was there at the same time as me. So the Bang on the Can aesthetic, which was embracing rock and the whole downtown scene, you know, kind of was a real kind of draw for a lot of us. So I think, you know, they were interested in, you know, as far as ideas for a dissertation, you know, one person I talked to said, why are you doing that? You should be, you know, talking about some kind of, you know, serious modernist music. And this wasn't a person who was not, I won't say who was, but he was very much a jazz oriented person. But my original plan was to talk about three pieces on the fringes of jazz. Mm. One of them Agartha, one of them Mingus's Three Worlds of Drums, and one of them City of Glass. And I spent about 2 months trying to figure out how to get the score to City of Glass, you mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. wrestling with Werner Herbers and Ebony Band and with North Texas. And I had no money for flying to Texas to do that kind of research. And so I just started on the Agartha part of it. And that spun itself out into, you know, roughly 180 pages of all sorts of stuff that, but then I think also that, I mean, well, Super Stupid, where that goes. I mean, I think that was obviously Funkadelic and, you know, maybe more so Sly and Family Stone and Hendrix were big influences on Miles' work of that period. But I think that idea of the mashup, you know, it's interesting that Miles, and you know this, that Miles, you know, also had this big infatuation with Stockhausen from that time, probably via Paul Buckmaster. And that, I think, is kind of what makes that method work for me, is that you've got something really sort of making it more complex than, and I shouldn't use the word complex because that's cheapening what Funkadelic does, which is, you know,
yeah,
beyond complex in its own right. But I think somehow if you're talking about Miles and his history, you know, well into his 40s by that point, nearing his 50s, I guess, I mean, there's that way, I think, of him in it was to somehow find. And, I think specifically, if you know the piece Rated X on Get Up With It, mm-hmm. it has no trumpet in it at all, and which I think is somehow telling of that time. But that's a piece that I think between that and Dark Magus, the album, are two that there was that reissue that they put out, I think Bob Belden and some producers put out, where they remixed a lot of that music. Mm-hmm. And to a person, they were all saying, oh, Dark Magus just sounded so awful and Rated X sounded so awful. I said, I love those. I thought those sounded wonderful. And again, you know, there was like a searing, you know, sort of high frequency, you know, I mean, a lot of the same things that Stockhausen was doing. And I found those are kind of the same things that Miles, you know, was after. You know, I assume that that was a sound that he wanted. I don't know how Tio Macero felt about it, but right. As far as listeners, I mean, Ja Wobble was a fan. And I think Lester Bangs was a fan, although he, you know, you get with Bangs, it's, you know, you read him one day and he's raving about something the next day. It's the worst thing that anyone ever did. But
this paper about the music of the 70s, I mean, you must have, it's a pretty rich period. It's a little bit overlooked. I mean, even within jazz. But when you say the music of the 70s, are you looking more at the popular music? Or, I mean, because also if you look at so-called classical music, it was a really interesting period.
I think, you know, I teach a class called Music of the 70s. And I think, why be teaching it this year? I can't remember. Holy cow. Like, that's how bad my memory's gotten. But one of the things I always started with, no, I will not be teaching. I have not taught that class actually in a while. But one of the things I started with was that idea that the 70s is kind of that end of an era. You know, in pop music, you look and you go, okay, obviously Hendrix, Beatles, you know, all your wonderful 60s totems break up, or they sell out somehow in the 70s. Armstrong dies in 71, Ellington dies in 74, Monk stops playing. You can sort of reel off all the things that kind of get, all these people change direction. Lots of people start, Miles and Ornette start using electronic instruments. And so as far as other controversies, classical music, that's where the rise of the Glass and Reich minimalist comes in, that at least starts to make people think, oh, there's a whole other way forward, even though it's not going to satisfy the people who saw modernism as sort of a singular trajectory. So you get that, but then you also lose Shostakovich, Barber, Britten, it's kind of the idea of ends of eras. Did I say Stravinsky? I don't remember, but
I don't think you did, but yeah, definitely that's another big loss.
But so it's kind of a time where, and you also get it, and it's not just here's a new revolution. Like, I think all the revolutions of the past, like 12 tone and bebop and free jazz, you can kind of say, okay, there was something there that we can feel good about, at least in theory, at least in idea, what you're trying to do. You can put an ideology in behind it and so forth. Whereas in the 70s, you get like Leonard Bernstein's Mass, which I love, and every teacher I had despised and probably still despises. Most of my friends still despise that. But that's kind of one of those things that, when I taught music in the 70s, I always brought up that piece because it, in that same way of Pippin and Jesus Christ Superstar and Godspell, it's kind of that moment where it's rock and roll invading Broadway, and for better or for worse.
It was the Hamilton of its day.
Yes, yes. So, I do feel, and maybe it's just because I grew up in that era that, I think I'm not sure what your relationship to Maynard Ferguson is. I think he was sort of the most beloved by young people and despised by critics and older people, musician at that time.
I would say my relationship was fraught, mainly because I was never a high note player. And when I went to music school, there were people who were into Maynard, and the only reason they liked him was because he played really high notes. And I didn't find that particular skill exceptionally interesting. I totally appreciate the qualities of Maynard and Bill Chase and all these kind of bands that were around. And I heard somebody recreate some Bill Chase a few years ago in the Trumpet Festival, and it was just it was so triumphant. It was so great. I hadn't heard that music in years. There's definitely qualities to it, but I'm attracted more to a trumpet player like Hugh Reagan and what he did in honoring Lester Bowie on this record. And you chose it as the title of the record, Hugh's Piece.
Just as an aside, you do know, of course, that Hugh played with Maynard for a
period. I didn't know that. No,
he did. He and we
go wash my mouth out with soap.
Well, that's interesting. He, Bruce Johnstone, we were trying to think of Kenny Wheeler, the people who actually played with both Maynard and with Anthony Braxton. So it's a small number. And Woody Shaw actually does. And Hugh says, but, no, Hugh, oh my gosh. I first heard Hugh, he was a graduate student in Northern Colorado when I started there as a freshman. And, I played in the big band that he led, and I don't think I knew that. I think I knew that he had been at Colorado State University before that, and that was about the extent of it. And it was one of those kind of things like, again, you put yourself in that environment where you go to that school. I think if you go to North Texas, then the, 1 o'clock band are gods, right in front of you. So Northern Colorado, Lab One. I mean, and granted, some of these people are just a year or two ahead of you, but certainly monstrous players there. And at the time, Hugh was, you know, the jazz chair for, you know, that year. And, oh my gosh, there was a concert that fall. I think I actually say this in the liner notes to the book or to the CD that they played Claire Fisher's In the Beginning, a big band arrangement of it. And it starts with this trumpet solo by Hugh and it's kind of like, I think I had heard him before that. But it was like maybe that moment I understood, holy cow. And maybe it's also playing in his band, and sort of getting to know, just how much he knew and, just how much of, what kind of potential he had as far as I could do this, I could do, And I mean, of course, the chops were, formidable. But then just the ideas, it just kind of felt like this could go, what I said about Lester Bowie is like he could go anywhere. And it was, really in a span of about a good 40, 50 seconds. Mm-hmm. I said, that is something I want. And, I must have written two or three pieces ripping that off because I so wanted to do, The Rise and Fall of the Black Death had a beginning that did exactly that. And I wanted Hugh to play it and I couldn't get him to play my senior recital. But, it was very life-changing that way. And, it's funny, ever since then, I have a lot of different recordings of him in various different ways and, settings and mediums and so forth. And just fundamentally there, he's always a player who I never get tired of listening to. And I feel also, that wasn't even necessarily getting the full brunt of what he can do. When you finally sort of heard him in solo settings and so forth. I think we're talking about some of his, records since that time. He has an album as a leader, which I don't know if it's been released on CD, but it was the Metaphysical Question, which I think he's recorded with different sized groups, and it's based on a 12-tone. And we actually performed that. He did a big band version of that with, the group at Northern Colorado. It's on part of an album where it's just a trio. It's him, Thurman Barker on drums, and John Lindberg, I think, on bass. And, the title track, Metaphysical Question, vast majority of aside. I mean, I think it's, about 20 minutes long and it's a lot of Hugh just playing. And it's kind of like he really just stretches out in a way. And I feel like he's, in that same way that we don't get to hear enough of Hugh because he's in Colorado, most of the time. And, when he comes out, he's playing, kind of in collective improv groups. He was playing with Butch Morris and David Murray a lot. And, he would get his moments here and you'd go, wow, it's Hugh Reagan, but it's like, it's great to hear him stretch out that way. So I think we're at a time now where, he's been playing with Art Ensemble and AACM. And I think it's wonderful. I think that we're getting to hear more of him. Mm.
Let's play a little bit of this. Thank you. A Prayer for Lester Bowie. So it's a piece by Hugh Reagan. It's on your record. It's the David Sanford Big Band, which we'll talk about. But I also thought that it was interesting that, you know, Hugh is so skilled at this thing that has become called conduction, creating a piece. You know, nobody's got music in front of them. They've got an extensive set of rules, hand symbols and cues, and Hugh is really amazing at it, as you can hear from the recording. Does conduction play a role in your work at all, ever?
I don't think so. I think what I'm bringing as a conductor tends to be, again, what I was saying about Poppet, that, you know, there are a handful of places, you know, depending on the piece. I have wondered, the first album that we did has, I have a big band arrangement of Elvin Jones's Three Card Molly. Then there's a point in there where there's a bunch of background figures. The solos are all sort of open form, except, you know, one point, once you kick in the background, then it's done. You know, I mean, the backgrounds go for 32-48 bars, and then it moves on. But that's about as the most that I can sort of bring to those. And that's also a piece where, you know, I have taken advantage of, you know, controlling the volume, or, you know, so, I mean, I think there are situations where I can, but I think what I'm doing in those situations is probably not that much different than what, you know, other big band leaders, you know, Kenton, right, Herman, and so forth, did with their groups. So, I mean, certainly that way that you're creating right on the moment that Hugh is doing is something that's not really in my arsenal. And I remember thinking that I could do something like Prayer for Lester Bowie without Hugh. I'm not wanting to do it. I never really wanted to do it. But I remember thinking I could lead it if necessary. But because I don't think I was really aware that Hugh had become, you know, so proficient as a conductor when I first suggested I was doing it. But then Hugh, you know, took it over, and it's, he's really a maestro about it.
Did a lot of his language come from Butch Morris? I know that they must have been together for years.
I would think so. I think it was specifically Butch Morris. I think he said that. You know, he worked with Braxton. He worked with Roscoe Mitchell. I think Leo Smith. But specifically, I think it was larger on time. I mean, I think for a very long time, he was working with Morris and David Murray. I saw them in New York back in 92, I think.
Wow. Yeah. Right. And that's about when Butch was really developing the technique of that, and then ultimately stopped playing cornet.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw Hugh doing this a little bit, and there were some similar things, but it seems like everybody who takes on conduction ends up growing appendages of their own, sort of new little limbs that take hold, and that becomes their own sort of thing, which is in some ways antithetical to what Butch had in mind. I mean, having written in depth about his process and really trying to codify it.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised, you know, because again, in Northern Colorado, Hugh was kind of doing conduction before, you know, with Metaphysical Question. He had hand signals, and he had things that, you know, again, you know, four or five different signals to control the piece. But when we started doing Prayer for Lester Bowie, he pulled out a baton, and I think he had been studying conducting. I mean, probably classical conducting. Certainly, you know, I think studying with Butch, you know, or studying Butch's work. But you know, that kind of technique is something I think that he has evolved, or he's, you know, kind of advanced with over the years. So that's really a new refinement of, you know, I would say for the last 5 years that I know of. And he might say something differently, but.
Well, yeah, I should call him. You know, he's a PhD now, so I have to call Dr. Reagan.
Yes.
There's a piece on here called Soldier and the CEO, where there's a section in the middle. It feels to me like you get to a similar place to some of the spaces that he brings the band into in his piece. And I know that the process of doing it and the technique of doing it is completely different. You know, in your case, it's clear it's all notated. Mm-hmm. But it's a really a wonderful, let me just play a short excerpt of that. Soldier and the CEO, and yeah, it's such a textural moment. It's very beautiful.
Thank you.
And I sort of feel like composition at that level often ends up approaching something that could feel like an improvisation.
That's interesting. I kind of like the idea that, you know, people often, you know, will say that, you know, Ellington played the orchestra, you know, was his instrument and so forth. And, you know, obviously I'm not trying to compare myself to Ellington, but that sense that the orchestration becomes that sort of artistry and not just, you know, backgrounds and, you know, filling out the changes and, you know, how many kind, you know, substitutions, you know, can you do and, you know, altered chords and, you know, all these ideas that, you know, we get so used to in arranging. I think, you know, when you're just really kind of painting it, occasionally you do hear stuff that just, you know, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, obviously Maria Schneider, you know, when she's on a roll, it's just, you know, feels like it's just spun out. I mean, even though there's certainly, you know, a lot of grit and, you know, in the moment kind of work to it. But yeah, that piece was hard to write. I mean, that's all still, you know, almost all those old ones from 2003 are all written on score, you know, in pencil and so forth. So, you know, I didn't make very many changes with them, even when I feel, you know, some of them I feel are perfect. That one, you know, I've been wrestling with for years, but I, you know, I think when it's, you know, when the players are on, it's just, I'm perfectly, I love it as it is. So.
Do you feel, I mean, you're in this unique place that is clearly in between what people think of as classical music and what, I avoid using the word jazz. I'll just say improvised music. And, you know, it's a unique space. It's always been a little bit fraught. It's always been a little, I don't want to say controversial, but let's say misunderstood. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, I mean, obviously, you've put a lot of thought into your work over the years, and you've written these serious dissertations. And I'm sure through the whole career, that meeting place of rigorous notation with spontaneity and improvisation has always been a discussion.
I feel like, I mean, one side of me thinks that if I wrote Mahler 2, I would never need to write improvisation because I'd be like, I just want to hear that 100,000 times and never listen to anything else. You know, I want to hear it played the exact same way, or, you know, as maybe a conductor's interpretation, that's as far as you want to go off the page with it. But on the other side of it, it's like, when you think of some of the highs that you get from what somebody else does, and, you know, it's something that, you know, I'm aware that, you know, City of Glass doesn't have any improvisation to it. I don't know that I have anything. I had a ballad, and even that one, it opens up into a piano solo at the end. I mean, you know, where there isn't some sort of improvisation, because I just always feel like you need somehow something, you know, to kind of take it into it. And nothing else. I mean, you're sort of aware that, you know, listen, I mean, going back to R&B of the 70s, I mean, the Ohio Players, if you go back and listen to that stuff, it's like, you know, if you listen closely, simple stuff of players in the background throwing in riffs that you know aren't, you know, just the riff, but just something they're making up on the spot. And if you took it out or changed it, it's different and it's lacking something. You know, and it's, you know, also that sense when you see a band live and you get that great, whoa, that was awesome. And it's like, you're not going to get that back again. And you're lucky if you did get a tape of it because you go, wow, that was perfect. And I suppose that's what I sort of wrestle with is when I hear something and I love it that way, I don't want it to change. And, you know, I think specifically like smaller group jazz, you know, it's changing every night. You know, nobody wants to come out and play something the same way. You know, as a pop singer, I won't name who sings a very famous song of hers. And it, you know, she sings it way differently than she did 40 years ago, certainly than it is on the album. And my favorite part of it on the album, which is probably how it's written, she doesn't do. And, you know, for whatever reason, I guess, you know, obviously she's tired of it after 40 years. Whereas me, I'm like, that's such the great part of it. So I'm rambling off. I apologize. But I don't know. When I think of, certain, you know, probably some of my favorite moments in a lot of these, I have a tendency to put soloists in, you know, kind of at the big moments. And they get a little bit covered up, maybe because I just get so excited about it. Kind of like that idea of the person soloing and, you know, the Greek chorus or the gospel choir, whoever is around them, is yelling amen so loud that maybe you don't hear them. And some people despise it. You know, it's, I like to think of it as, if you ever saw the movie The Dresser, where, you know, they're doing King Lear and he's like doing the storm scene and, you know, they're like, you know, and the dresser's downstairs saying he wants more noise. They want the storm to be as loud as possible. He wants to have to shriek over it. I don't know that that's something that people, sorry, I'm okay. That's going back to the lack of
something. No. That right there really gets at the crux of the question is like nothing you can write is going to equal that chorus shouting as loud as they possibly can. I want more storm noise.
Yes.
Is like the equivalent of, okay, the page needs to stop here. And then I want X, Y, Z to happen. And you, as a composer, you're creating the context in which it all happens. So you're, you know, it's not, no improvisation, I think anyway, is just complete random unexpected sound. It's all of a piece with who the person is and what the context of the piece is and how you choose as a composer to set it up and create little ground rules, whether spoken or unspoken. You know, here, this is going to happen and you could do pretty much whatever you want here, but you've got to deal with this and this and this. And then a good improviser is going to take that situation and go, well, thank you, sir. Yes, I will dance this dance and figure it out for you, you know, and then that's how you get those beautiful, exciting results, I think.
I get excited at the idea that a soloist gets into, you know, any surrounding, obviously, you know, like such that, you know, when they walk in, you know, like I'd like to think that, you know, when you go and see, you know, a combo, that person is just chomping at the bit to get out there every night with that piano player, you know, and that bass player. And, you know, that particular configuration just is inspiring in and of itself. So, you know,
interesting. Well, now you're orchestrating through your band. Like you said, you weren't going to do.
Did I say it? Okay.
Well, no, you were talking about Ellington and just saying, but what you just described, which I can relate to totally, of, you know, the excitement of going to see someone play and being like, wow, those human beings, they're getting up and they have this relationship and they're all really excited to explore what's next in this context. I think that's great. And I think it's really interesting to me that your band, I mean, it's newly named the David Sanford Big Band, which I think is great. Because for the longest time it was called the Pittsburgh Collective, and I never really understood. I mean, I guess I could have asked you, so I'll ask you now, but I think more like than the naming, it's the collective experience of everybody and the fact that you're here now with this record and it's a band that's taken shape over a lot of years.
I think so. I think, I value counterpoint, and not necessarily, you know, contrapuntal, but yes, contrapuntal. But specifically every voice. I want to hear every voice as much as possible. And it was a pain in the neck as far as mixing this thing. Cause you know, you got 21 tracks, 20 tracks plus, you know, several on the drum set, you know, and you're, you know, wrestling saying, well, I want the drums to be big and present the way they are with Mel Lewis, but then the bass has got to be there all the time. But then you want the piano out there like Roland Hanna, but then you want lead trumpet to sort of ride this. But then it's like, I don't want to leave the trombones out. As a trombonist, I remember, I don't know how many, you know, there are plenty of people that was, well, the trombone is the left hand is what it falls down to. And you're like, well, no, you know, like, yeah. So I want that kind of, so, but I kind of want that idea that everybody can hear themselves and that, you know, all those stories are significant in some way. And that's, you know, I think musically speaking, I was trying to think of a piece that really kind of gets, I think All About Rosie by George Russell is one. Oh, and it's a smaller band. I think it's only two trombones, maybe, or one trombone, I think, in the original one. But, you know, you do hear every, you know, you got the guitar that just kind of sings out over it. And, you know, when you can hear everything, you know, to me, I get goosebumps. So it's like, okay, I can go back and listen to this 30 times and hear different parts every time and then hear the relationship between the two. So, yeah, I think that's, yeah, that's a big part of what I love about big bands.
Wow. Is that why you didn't have your name on it for so many years?
There's a lot of reasons for, I mean, I still feel weird when I'm writing my resume and say, you know, I used to be able to say he's a conductor of the Pittsburgh Collective. It's easy. You know, the big band of Pittsburgh, he's a conductor of the David Sanford. It's kind of like, well, of course he is. You know, it's like, you're the collector.
I mean, when I tell people I'm the trumpet player in the Dave Douglas Quintet, it's no surprise, but it's also like gets at a basic truth, I think.
Right. Well, we all know the Dave Douglas Quintet very well, you know, whereas, you know, like if, you know, Bob Smith starts a big band, of course it's the Bob Smith big band. So, I like the whole Pittsburgh. I mean, maybe I'm hiding behind something. And again, that's probably something for a therapist. But but Pittsburgh, I mean, to quote a filmmaker who has been canceled, and I probably shouldn't, I won't even imitate him because then we give it away. But I do idolize, I'm paraphrasing because he's not talking about Pittsburgh, but I idolize the city all out of proportion. You know, I lived there till I was 11, and, you know, my favorite amusement park was there. When I lived there, it was the best roller coaster in the world. Obviously, it was the best baseball team in the world in 1971. It was the best football team in the world for 4 out of 6 seasons. And, you know, my father, who lived his entire life there, will tell you it had the most beautiful women in the world. It had the greatest, you know, view of any city from Mount Washington. It had the best view coming out of the tunnel into the city and so forth. And, you know, I believed all of it.
A great, great jazz lineage.
Yes, my father was like the father in My Big Fat Greek Wedding. He would tell you every jazz musician encyclopedically, you know, Art Blakey, Stanley Turrentine, George Benson. Who?
Mary Lou Williams, right?
Mary Lou Williams, certainly. Nestico, Jim Pugh, you know, Father Hines, you know, the list goes on.
And you quickly ran past the word roller coaster, and I just wanted, in case people don't know, David Sanford is an enormous roller coaster aficionado and geek. And I want to get a link to this thing that you wrote about your roller coaster vacation this summer, where you have in-depth reviews of how many different roller coasters from around the country, like 20?
This trip, I think we only rode because, not to get to whining, but due to ride closures, long lines, right, because of the time, sure, of year, I think we only rode about maybe 15 to 20 rides on this trip. But
I see.
Total, my kids and I have ridden about like well over 200.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. All right. We'll put that up somewhere, a link to that. And that is just incredible. And it's been great talking to you about the music. I probably have more questions now. So somewhere down the road, we'll do this again. But I was going to play Subtraff on the way out and just mention that when we first started talking about this record, you were thinking of calling it Subtraff, I guess, after this piece.
Yes. I feel like the title is an acronym, but I don't think I really don't need to say what it stands for.
Okay. All right.
Bottom line is, though, it's just supposed to be the most sort of Weltschmerz, Adorno post-Holocaust level of blues that you can get, which blues tends to not be. Blues tends to always be sort of something that people smile and have a beer and party with now, whereas
it's more like a threnody.
Yes, yeah. But with, you know, blues in the background, I think it's kind of a way to try to get to the, ultimately it's a feature for Mike Christensen. And I just would love to say that Mike Christensen, who was also at Northern Colorado, who was also a featured soloist in the beginning, is, you know, when we started the same time at Northern Colorado. And that was kind of one of these things where I played trombone sometimes. When I heard him, I was like, okay, there is a guy who plays trombone seriously. And just his approach to blues, I feel like he's a person who's, you know, literally talent deserving wider recognition. So I was very ecstatic to be able to feature him on this. And
that is great. Thank you so much. And it's been great talking. And stick around. We'll talk about Miles Davis, Agartha in the extra. But for everybody listening to this show, you can go pick up A Prayer for Lester Bowie at Greenleaf Music. It's the David Sanford Big Band, and here's the piece Subtraft. David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Douglas.
thank you for listening to this Greenleaf Music Podcast, A Noise from the Deep. Come see us again soon. We do about an episode a month, and you can listen to a lot of them wherever you get your podcasts. The first 30 episodes are available to subscribers at greenleafmusic.com. So please come on over and join us, and we'll talk to you again real soon. Stay safe.